different because it's not so funny. I mean, maybe some images are, but I don't think that's the first thing we think of when we see the images.
No.
And also, again, the narration is really open-ended. It's not really... I don't think it's telling a story so much.
No.
Except for a few, maybe.
Right. I feel like a thread is suggested, but sort of the point of it is confusion, mystery, not knowing what's going on, feeling lost, you know, or not knowing who to trust. It has that kind of sense about it.
Mm-hmm. And we should mention Waterstone Gallery. Is it just waterstonegallery.com?
Yes.
Is that? Yes. Yeah. And also, just real quickly, Artist Talk you guys are doing soon?
Coming Sunday at 11.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
At the gallery.
Right. Okay. So if you haven't got enough information today, you can go and get more. So just to kind of stick with these photos for a moment, you presented them small and in a grid. I love that approach, and I've certainly seen this with other photographers. Tell us why. What led you to doing it that way?
My previous work, I would mat with deep mats and the whole deal, and each piece is sort of presented, and it's its own story. This work, because it did sort of fit together. I see it. There's 20 pieces in the show right now, and they're mm-hmm. set up as a grid, and they can be looked upon as though that grid is one piece,
mm-hmm.
or there can be individual pieces. And I didn't want any mats. I wanted them, it's full bleed, mounted on Sintra.
Right.
Yes.
And there's no glass in front of it or anything
glass,
like that.
No glass, and they have a little French cleat on the back, so they actually stand off the wall maybe half an mm-hmm. inch or something.
Mm-hmm.
And in that manner, they almost become like tiles also. As the single piece, they're very colorful, so you have these squares of different colors mm-hmm. Around in the whole piece too. And also, again, it makes me think a little bit about like a book cover, like a Pulp Fiction book cover. It has no frame. It's mm-hmm. it's the image goes to the edge.
Well, you know, when I first saw them, I kind of wondered, like, how did you come across them? I can almost imagine that it almost seems like you might have I don't want to say an accident, but like, how did you come to the blur, out of focus, simplistic? I mean, this is really different from other things I know about you. Did you discover it? Was it an accident? I mean, how did it come to be?
It was, the background story is that I moved to Seattle a couple of years ago, and it seems that every time I move, it throws my artwork into the air.
Yeah.
It's like I can't keep doing what I did. I mean, I may return to that, but so I was struggling a bit with my usual very detailed, meticulous vignettes.
Uh-huh.
I did, you know, a little bit of that work up there, but I started.
Was it because of the studio? What was how? Or just you just felt like the stories weren't right? Or
I think, you know, it was my own sense of disorientation.
Uh-huh. Being new in some
place. Yeah, and not quite finding my footing, not knowing if what I did is what I still want to do, but not knowing what's next. And just as a way to goof around, because I do work in such a meticulous, you know, deliberate way, I just started fooling around with throwing everything out of focus, not setting up any set at all, which usually takes a tremendous amount of time uh-huh. to create a set, and just letting whatever was in the background fall out of focus. And then I started out actually just doing these character studies, you know, just little portraits of these miniature characters I have. But then I started throwing them out of focus, and I started to see this atmosphere and, emerge. And and all the mystery and like what's going on here. So then I started a little more deliberately in that direction.
And okay, so they're kind of a self-portrait in a way.
I guess a psychological self-portrait, yes.
Right. I mean, like in ways that maybe maybe some of the other pieces were, just because you're funny and cute, and some of your work is funny and cute. But this to me seemed much more like you.
Yeah, I mean, I think the layer of, I think it's very
revealing. This is not a bad thing, by the way.
No,
okay?
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
In the way that I feel it's revealing of the state of mind I was in.
Uh-huh.
So that's how I think it is, a self-portrait.
And so how long have you been in Seattle now?
It's going on 2.5 years.
And
yeah.
is it Is that stage over or is it still there?
It's still there to a point. I was thinking a little while ago, I was starting to feel better being there and have a little more community around me. And I thought, oh, maybe I can't do this work anymore. Maybe it's over. But then I managed to get a few more done for the show. Yeah. And I thought, oh, well, it is still there some. You know, Seattle's not Portland to me. I was here so long.
Right.
And so there is still a lot.
You're still a Portlander, really.
I'm still a Portlander at heart.
Yeah. Was it liberating being free of the narration part of it? I mean, like you said, you always create a tight set. So, like, this is all, like, telling this story. Right. There's the mountain here. Here's the laundry over here. I mean, you didn't have to do any of that anymore.
No. Perhaps it should have been liberating, but there was part of me that felt nervous. When I was first doing it, like I said, I just felt like I was goofing around, and I didn't think it counted. I thought, well, this isn't really
art. This is how I was when I did the Judd montage. When I did that exercise was just for me. It was the same thing, like, okay, let me just do this 1+1 over here. I call it 1+1 exercise. You know, it was just like, let me just do this.
Yes.
Yeah, it's hard to take sometimes seriously.
I didn't take it seriously. Yeah. And also I have that deep working class ethic and I felt like if this isn't hard, then it's not, it can't count. This is not really, really, really hard for me. Of course, once I became more deliberate about it, it became more hard.
And so can I just ask you too, another thing about the blur and all of that. Is that all in the camera or is that Photoshop?
That's all in camera. Or sometimes I put things in front of the lens to diffuse the image through it, but it's all done in camera. It's not a Photoshop trick.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then titles: Witness, Betrayal, The Letter, Snitch. So do the talk to me about titling, because I bet you didn't do these kinds. Did you? Have you always had sort of interesting titles? Is it part of the whole thing?
I always enjoy titling. I wanted short titles and I wanted that nostalgic sense of, you know, going to a Dashiell Hammond, you know, mystery or something. You know, I wanted that kind of, you know, gangsters from the 40s or spies from the 60s, you know, things like that. And again, not telling too much. I just don't want to tell a lot.
Don't want to tell us that. Yeah. You're listening to KBOO Portland. My name is Ava Lake, and this is Art Focus. If you want more information about this radio show, you can go to kboo.fm/artfocus, and you can see links to my guests. You can go back to the schedule, and there's audio files of almost all the interviews I've done here. I've been here about 5 years. I have with me today two artists who are showing at Waterstone Gallery right now, so that's waterstonegallery.com. The show is Unfamiliar Faces. I have with me Lisa Kaser. She made sculptures, and Grace Weston, who did photographs. So it's a two-person show. So, Lisa, you had mentioned something about you had sculpture that you'd been working on, but you actually do a lot of different things, right? Is that true? You're also drawing, painting, and
I started out studying textiles. Uh-huh. So 30-plus years ago, that's where most of my interests lie, and things that I was exploring had to do with different types of cloth. And but I have always drawn. Mm-hmm. My dad was a cartoonist and a painter, went to the museum art school back in the 50s. Ah. So my brother and I were constantly surrounded by, of course, drawing materials, and so that was just something that.
Then your mom did quilts? So
my mom was a sewer and did quilts. So I kind of teamed up with her to learn the hand sewing. I was interested in anything that had to do with textiles and lace making, kind of obscure kind of tatting, trapunto.
What the
anything.
Heck is that?
What's trapunto?
Yeah, what is that?
It's a textile technique where you slit the fabric from the back and stuff it. Basically, you add kind of, it creates a relief, and it's used in quilting and
I've seen this
primarily in quilting.
Yes, but also. There's a word for it that I'm forgetting now, but Marie Antoinette, the clothing had the same kind of a thing. It had a three-dimensional relief mm-hmm. quality to it. I learned about it because in Chanel, they did a whole collection based on Marie Antoinette, and they did knits that imitated this same
trapunto.
Yes, that you're talking about. Okay. But we had the French word. I don't remember it right now, but it's exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. So, okay, you were doing textiles like 20 or 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. Now that's really, when you said that's really a hip thing to do nowadays, like compare for me how it was your trajectory starting way back then to how things are now. Because I see a group of artists, young artists these days, men and women, into, you know, textiles and that kind of thing.
Well, it was interesting looking back. Well, I kind of felt isolated in that there weren't a lot of my peers doing work outside of weaving. There was still a large weaving community in Portland. But I wasn't really sure. I liked weaving, but that was kind of, you had to go where the weaving was to find a textile studio or a textile program.
Right.
And I was on a really limited, really limited budget when I was looking at school. So I was looking in Oregon, and between University of Oregon and Oregon State, there were textile programs. You could get a degree.
Mm-hmm.
And the one at Oregon State was in a basement, and there was Pat Sparks was running that felting, and she was more actually working in felt, which was really intriguing. I didn't know about it at that time, but and then I went to University of Oregon. It was a better program.
What years was this? What years were they? Were you there?
I graduated in 84, so I did a 5-year program. I mean, I did a fifth year there for studio work. So
I went to U of
in
all.
Early 80s.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't much better than the basement at Oregon State. We were in a Quonset. We were in the old science lab across the river, the mill stream.
I remember this place. I remember that place.
Yeah, it was not much better, but it was above ground.
Right.
And I was like, okay. And I really liked Barbara Setsu Pickett was the instructor, the head instructor of the, and you could get a BFA, which it was kind of hard to find. And it was limited. I wasn't looking beyond Oregon, actually, because I didn't know how to do it financially.
Right.
So I started there, and everything was weaving.
Right.
And she taught an off-loom program, and I learned felting, and that was it. I was just, that's what
felting.
I wanted to do.
Felting. I find that such an interesting word, felting. This means you're taking felt to make something. Is that
you
all
make
that
the
means?
Felt.
Oh, you make the felt. Is that, so are you making the felt in your pieces now?
I make all the material that I use. Yeah.
That's just so amazing to me. I mean, there's a part of me that thinks, I guess I thought like, well, she found felt and made herself animals. I mean, a little bit related to plush, if you know what I'm talking
That's
about.
That's fine, but I do make it.
But you make it. Yeah, you make it. Well, what do you think about plush? Do you know what I'm talking about?
What do I think about plush animals?
Well, that's an art thing that happened, plush.
Sure.
But you're much more deep than that, right? Like,
well, I have a different relationship to the actual material that I'm working with.
Right.
So that, in a way, instructs my... I mean, I like handling it. I like making it. It's not because... I just like the whole process. Felt making is this physical... physical process of taking a raw fiber.
Uh-huh.
I take the fleece from the sheep.
Ooh.
And, I mean, which is... you know, I'm going to very small farms, and so it's not like it's huge production.
Uh-huh.
And they're raised for their wool, so there's it's pretty friendly as far as working with animals.
Oh, no judgment on my part.
No, I want to clarify that because actually quite sensitive to that.
Okay.
So I hand process it. So you start with it. You know, you separate the fibers, you card it. I have a little hand carders, and then you go through this process of kind of cleaning the fibers, basically, and aligning the fibers, and then you layer the fibers and make material out of it through heat, friction, and a little bit of moisture.
So this exhibition that's at Waterstone is called Silent Partners, yes?
Mm-hmm.
What's that mean? Talk to us a little bit about who What do we see on the wall? I mean, I guess that is something we should really describe. I think it's in some ways easier for me to describe Grace's work, maybe because I know her, but also photography. For some reason, I can go there. Mm-hmm. What do we see on the wall when we come into your exhibition?
I have three pieces that are tabletops, so they're resting on a ground surface there, and the rest are hanging, and kind of they're not suspended, but they're affixed to the wall. But I wanted the appearance of them floating, and being in the process of either some form of movement, either dropping, floating, hovering, that kind of thing. So, and I'd never done that with my work before, with the 3D work. So that was definitely a departure from my other work that was all fixed on bases. And I really didn't know how it was going to look. I didn't even have a way of testing it before I came to the gallery, because where my studio is now is in my home, and I was kind of propping them up. So mm-hmm. I hadn't actually...
Who knows how it was going to look on a wall and all that?
Or? I knew it was possible because they were light, mm-hmm. and they were going to be. I put the hangers on. I made the hangers and hung them when the day of the hanging. So we kind of experimented a little bit with that, and So that part has been probably the most exciting, and just the return to textiles and leaving. Working with more mixed materials behind this for this show, I wanted them malleable and movable and soft. Yeah, I get a lot of people coming in wanting to hold them because
right, they don't touch them and everything, right?
Yeah, yeah. And they're bigger than I thought they were going to be. They just turned out a little bit larger.
Mm-hmm.
So
the way that they are displayed is not necessarily how they would be for anybody. Let's say I purchased one. It doesn't just go on a wall as it is then, right?
You can,
but I'm just saying it could be maybe done another way too.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. You can duplicate what's been how they're presented in the gallery, but a lot of those you can lay down. You can mm-hmm. lay them down mm-hmm. and prop them up because they're soft bodied. Some have little weights in them, so
to give them more.
Yeah,
substance kind of, or keep them more where they're supposed to be.
Yeah,
right.
Like I'll created a bean bag for the inside of the belly, so they can. You could put them on a stand if you wanted, like rest them on the corner of a shelf, or yeah. And the felt is thick enough that in sewing them the way I did that, it does hold its shape. You can move it, but they're still movable.
So is this typical for the kind of work you do with textiles now? I mean, you're doing a lot of different things, right? I mean, this kind of character-based, you know, it's personality, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You're making things that are not a personality. How about that? No?
I think they still are. Okay. It's, but I think it's like Grace was saying that this, her work is reflective of... kind of this self-portrait. I feel these in a way are a little bit self-portraits as well.
Talk to us about that.
Where Grace had a more physical journey, even though it affected her psychologically, and I had a shuffling of my studio as well, but not to the extreme, and I'm wanting to move in the direction of animation. And all my characters have been rigid and heavily waxed and not really movable. And because in the back of my mind, I want to do that, I think that was something that dictated how the work was going to be. But I wanted to simplify, because I was putting a lot of my tools in storage when I moved my studio.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up not finding another studio and working just on my dining room table. And really, I just said, I've got 30 years of felt here that I've created, scraps and...
Oh, cool. So I'm kind of building from previous work in a way.
Kind of. I mean, I don't throw anything away because you can really recycle the wool. You can refelt it.
Uh-huh.
It's a durable material, so you can use it over and over again, which I have in a lot of the cases. So it does go back to when I dyed all my materials. And so 30 years ago, I was doing a lot of that. And
wow. So. You know, it's always interesting when someone asks you, how long does it take you to make something, right? Mm-hmm. 30 years.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm not charging enough for this work.
Right? But just like that to me is like a perfect example, yeah. A perfect answer. I mean, you just made them, whatever. You've got all these other shows going on. But in fact, I mean, the work is took 30 years to make. I just find that incredible.
Mm-hmm. It is nice to kind of talk about that. And it does come up in discussion when people are asking specific questions about, like, did you make it? And I say, I'm not dying anymore, but, you know, I still have this material that I created way back when, and I want to use it. I love it still. And when you're stitching little pieces together to make a big piece, I can do that now because I have all these scraps. And but it was part of simplifying my life, which is the direction I'm going in. And I think it's my age. I'm moving in. Things are more inward for me right now than ever before. And I think the work has come from just where I'm going. And this is the thing. How do I describe it? It's my development, I guess, as a human being that I'm letting come out in the work more. Mm-hmm. So it has to.
I think it's great that it comes all so much from the past and you're consolidating and bringing it in. Like you're saying, I'm simplifying. It's almost like taking this great big room of stuff and condensing it down. Mm-hmm. And the statement then is you're taking all that stuff, so all that substance is still there, but it's, you know, it's more to the point. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
That's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. And I don't think I didn't realize what was going on. And it's kind of after the fact you look at it and you can, I think, better understand what took place in the process of making it.
Yes.
And it's really cool because I think we both had interesting journeys, but up till this point, yeah.
So I'm have to wrap this up. Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been with Grace Weston and Lisa Kaser, who have a show at Waterstone Gallery. They have an artist talk, which is going to be this Sunday at the gallery, waterstonegallery.com, at 11 o'clock. Want to let you know I won't be here next week, but then the week afterwards, I'm going to have Vanessa Rennick on with me, who's got a million things going on, but she has a show that's going to be at the, maybe it's already opened. No, it's going to open soon at the Merrillhurst Art Gym. So we're going to talk about that. My name's Ava Lake. Thanks so much for listening to Art Focus. I'll be talking with you in 2 weeks.
You're listening to KBOO Portland Community Radio. Yeah!
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the JHS Annual Multicultural Film Festival's presentation of Two Americans. This documentary considers the status of undocumented immigrants in light of Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio's civil rights violations. This showing of Two Americans will be facilitated by Mr. Freddy Trujillo, who will lead the discussion following the movie. Two Americans will be shown at the North Portland Neighborhood Library at 512 North Killingsworth on Tuesday, April 8th, starting at 6 p.m. More information on this event can be found online at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to news headlines in English and Spanish at noon for Tuesday, April 8th on KBOO. A bomb exploded in a passenger carriage on a train in southwestern Pakistan today while it was stopped at a station in the town of Sibi. This killed at least 14 people and wounded about 50 others. A separatist group called the United Baluch Army has claimed responsibility for the attack. In a text message to the news media outlet Reuters, the group said its actions were in response to raids by Pakistani security forces. The day before the train bombing, Pakistani security forces claimed to have killed 30 separatists. A local official said that the bomb was in a passenger's bag and detonated remotely. The conflict between Baluch nationalists and the government of Pakistan has spanned many years. rebels in the Baluch region claim that the country has exploited its resources without regard for the local population. The U.S. Supreme Court will not hear a case challenging New Mexico's anti-discrimination law. The law at issue prohibits businesses from discriminating against people on the basis of race, religion, or sexual orientation. In this case, a photography business called Elaine Photography, operating in New Mexico, refused to serve a same-sex couple. The business claimed that the law violates its First Amendment protection of speech by compelling the business to create content it objects to. In earlier arguments, the owner of Elaine Photography argued that complying with the law violated her right to free expression of religion. Because the U.S. Supreme Court chose not to review the case, the unanimous decision by the New Mexico Supreme Court that the law was valid and not in violation of any rights stands. You've been listening to news headlines on KBOO. I'm Kelly Sunrose. Tune in at 5 p.m. weekdays for more local, regional, and global news produced right here in our Portland studio.
And now, headlines in Spanish. Continúa el debate sobre una reforma migratoria y crece la presión por un cambio inmediato en la aplicación de leyes en esta materia. Sindicalistas, ONGs y líderes políticos se han sumado a las manifestaciones y exigen el freno a las deportaciones masivas y los abusos contra migrantes en los últimos meses. Activistas del grupo Dream Action Coalition recordarán diariamente frente a la Casa Blanca a todos aquellos que han sido impactados por las deportaciones. En estas acciones intentan detener el éxodo de personas que han sido deportados sin haber cometido ningún delito. Un extenso reportaje del diario The New York Times publica el día de hoy que 2/3 de los 2 millones de deportados durante la administración del presidente Obama fueron acusados de delitos menores o no tenían antecedentes penales y solo el 20% fueron acusados de delitos mayores. Asimismo, el diario publica que la mayoría de los deportados son mexicanos menores de 35 años. El gobierno de México ha comenzado el desarme de autodefensas en Michoacán. En un ambiente tenso, ya que la policía comunitaria se niega rotundamente a dejar las armas, se han llevado a cabo manifestaciones y cierres de carreteras para impedir el avance del ejército. Las autodefensas han pedido a sus seguidores en los diferentes municipios de Michoacán que avisen si observan el movimiento de soldados o policías hacia sus comunidades para impedir que logren desarmarlos. Esto es todo por el momento, les informó Tania Gómez Daza.